Once again, hello, everybody. I'm Gary Thorne with The Sports Rivals. It is brought to you by the Believe Podcast Network, the number one podcast network for professionals. Do you believe? As always, our purpose here is to preserve memories of classic sports rivalries, and we do it through the words of those who participated in them. We like to say that these are the rivalries that are described from the inside out. And what a delight today to have two of the great names of Major League Baseball joining us to talk about a real rivalry. Steve Garvey was in the majors from 1969 to 1987, played with the Dodgers from 69 to 82, and went on to have tremendous years with the San Diego Padres from 83 through 87. Steve is a 10-time All-Star. He was the National League MVP in 1974. Has a World Series ring from 1981, and he was a member of one of the most renowned infields in the history of baseball that featured Ron Say at third, Bill Russell at short, Davey Lopes at second, and Steve Garvey himself at first base, a four-time Gold Glove Award winner recognized as a leader both with the Dodgers and the San Diego Padres. And joining Steve is Tony Perez. Perez played with the Cincinnati Reds two different occasions from 64 to 76, and then again in 84 to 86 when he wound up his career. In between, he had time with the Expos, with Boston, and with Philadelphia. Tony also ended up managing both the Reds and in Florida. Three World Series championships for Tony Perez, 75, 76, and 90. He had one of the most stupendous RBI records of any major league player. He had over 100 plus RBIs in a season, seven major league seasons. And Tony was voted into the Hall of Fame in 2000. Now, while Steve Garvey was with that tremendous infield with the Dodgers, Tony Perez was with the big red machine in Cincinnati. The red machine of the 70s went to four World Series in 7 years. They won two of those World Series. Tony Perez was part of that great lineup playing at first base. Sparky Anderson, the manager, said of him that Tony Perez was the heart and soul of that big red machine, which featured, and listen to the names on this, Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, Johnny Bench, Dave Concepcion, George Foster, Ken Griffey, and Cesar Geronimo. Those were the big eight in that lineup of the big red machine. So Tony Perez and Steve Garvey join us to talk about the rivalry that went on, especially during the 70s, between the Dodgers and the Reds. Because during that 70s period in the American League West, the Reds won that division six times, the Dodgers won it three times, and the Dodgers ended up finishing second six times. So you talk about a rivalry that was hot during the 70s, it was the Reds and the Dodgers in the National League West. Gentlemen, it's great to have you with us. Let me just start a conversation.
Wait a second, Gary.
Go ahead.
Tony, pay you off or what? I sound like Avis compared to Hertz. My Lord. That emphasis on him in second six times, you know. Okay. I realize my place.
Well, let's kick it off with that.
Yeah.
I mean, how hot was it and how big a rivalry in the 70s was it, Steve Garvey?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you look at the Dodgers and the Giants rivalry, going back to the boroughs of New York, and you think of that as the classic rivalry. And of course, the old story of O'Malley always won it, upping Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, and then letting it out that he thought he was going to go to San Francisco, and Stoneham rushing out there and doing a deal for this candlestick point to be the first team out west, and comes back and he has a press conference. The Giants are going to San Francisco. And of course, O'Malley 2 days later had a press conference that the Dodgers were going to Los Angeles, which caused Stoneham to be drunk for 2 weeks. But that rivalry went from east to west coast. But I've always said from 73 to about 84, there was no greater rivalry in baseball. And I think Tony can attest to it, too. Would play each other 18 times a year. 16 of them would be less than four runs. One team would have a blowout. as the other would, but the mutual respect. And Gary, you mentioned the players on the Reds, and then of course with the Dodgers, with Smith and Baker and Monday and Yeager catching, and you know, our pitching staff and Lasorda, and the rivalry between Lasorda and Sparky made for arguably, you know, generationally the greatest rivalry during that period.
Yeah, I think it was more. Both managers have more rivalry and the players did, because when we get to sit to Dodger Stadium, the first thing we do is get dressed and loosen up a little bit and going early to watch you guys hit in the batting cage, because we had to chat with you guys and tell you how we're gonna beat you and you guys really claim, you know. That was the rivalry we have. Well, we have, you know, with Ron Say and those guys. I mean, that was great. I mean, the rivalry was because I don't know how we play. We on the East, we end up in the West division.
Yeah, that's
I never understand that. That's the question I still ask me, because I never relate how so far away we can play you guys. I think it was bad for the Dodgers too. They don't want the Reds over there. They want San Francisco.
Yeah, you in Atlanta, Tony, right? Both of you guys were out in the West, and
right.
But you know, I think again, starting in '73, when the group of us came up out of that great draft the Dodgers had of Valentine, Buckner, Pishorek, Say, Lopes, myself, all kind of came together. I had been up and down for a couple of years, but 73 was when we finally, the infield came together. I was the last piece. I was a wild arm third baseman and not a big demand for that, but I started to keep improving as a hitter. And early that year, I all of a sudden started pinch hitting for Walt Alston and ended up pinch hitting from the third inning, you know, when the starter gets shelled, to being the guy in the ninth inning to get up there. And then January 23rd of 73, I get a pinch hit against you guys. Freddie Norman used to kill us, and I was sitting on the bench, and he had a one hitter going into the seventh. Pitcher's coming up, and he said, "It's 1-0." And he looked at me and he says, "Get up there and hit one out, or at least get on. Somebody get on." So I took Freddie up the middle, and you know, you win. I think it was 1-2-0. And I'm sitting in my locker between games, and all of a sudden, Alston walks by and he looks at me. He says, "You ever play first base?" And I went, "Oh, sure." Well, I had played one game in Little League and one game in AAA, but I wasn't going to tell him no. And he said, "Get a glove and play first. We're struggling against lefties for the Reds, and don't trip over the bag and get a few hits, and let's see if we can split this doubleheader." And first inning, first throw from Russell, goes in the hole, throws it in the dirt, and I pick it. And I look at my glove, and who I'd borrowed from, I think, Jay Johnstone or something. And a couple innings later, I do another one, come off the bag, make a tag, get a double, drive in two runs. And when it's said and done that night, we win. And, you know, those days, and Tony, you experienced a lot of them, when everything comes together and you make a difference and your hard work pays off. And I'm just sitting there, and out of the corner of my eye, Walter Alston comes through the tunnel and to my right and doesn't stop. And I hear, "You're in there tomorrow." And I look at Yeager and I said, "Is he talking to you or me?" He says, "I think it's you, Gard." And I was in there the next day. And that was really the beginning of my career. You know, 15 years as a first baseman and part of that fraternity of Tony and McCovey and all the great first basemen, you know, during that generation. But that was the start, because I hung in there and I kept getting out at 2:30 in the afternoons, and I started going the other way more and making myself more of a complete hitter. And I think we had something like a 10 or 12 game lead against the Reds, and it started to disintegrate when we went to Cincinnati, and your old catcher. Remember that? Hit the grand slam, and that was it for that bunch of young Dodger kids. But it set the tone really from that point on for the next decade. And, you know, you wonder how things come about. We finally, when you left, you know, we finally won a few divisions. And
yeah, it's what I used to thought. I thought Tommy Lasorda that. I said, because he come out one time and said to me, we beat you guys in 77 and 78. We got you guys. So we thought, but I left in 76. That's why you did it. And I always get on Tommy about that because I wasn't there. I wasn't there when you guys started winning. With 75 and 76, no.
What happened? What happened? Why did you go? Did they make you an offer you could refuse? I'm quite sure.
And not really. At the end of 76 season, Howson, the general manager, he called me in the office. He called me in the office and said, Tony, if we get the right deal, we might trade you. We're going to trade you. I say, well, I was surprised. I don't think about to winning two World Series in a row and my team doing so good. And he told me about, Dan Driesen, the kid, they play for first base and two. He's a good player, great player too. And he sitting there for 2-3 years behind me. And the Red, I don't know if they want to cut in salary because I wasn't making that much money. But they
we didn't make that more. Much back at that time.
I made more than Andreessen do. And they say, well, if we get the right trade, we're going to trade you. I say, well, the only thing I'm going to ask you is what I being a contending thing, I want you to trade me to to a team who had a chance. And he said, he said, contender, you can make anything a contender, Tony. I said, why you want to trade me? And, it's what I say. But, when they call me, the last 2 years, 75, 76, we win the World Series. That was fine with me. But coming to spring training those 2 years, Sparky come out to me and say, I say, Tony, I had to get Driesen by at least 200 bats. I say 200 bats are going to sit around a lot. And it's what I did those 2 years. I wasn't happy at all. Yeah. I was happy because we're winning. He was doing great too. He was doing good. But, I wasn't sit around was my, what I like. And it's like when they call me and they trade me, I could say no to the trade. Because I was a veteran, I had the right to say no, I don't want to go. But my feeling was, how am I going to sit in there for another two years or whatever, not playing that much, that's what I said the trade. That's what they gave me a good contract and I 3 years and I signed.
That was the old Dodger philosophy, it seems to me. And it seems like overthinking by the general manager and forecasting and looking at a player that's starting to age somewhat. 34, 35 back then is what now? 30, 31, 29. But you were still performing. You went out every day. You rarely got hurt. And I equate it to, 1982, when I'm still productive, and the Dodger philosophy had been always been, well, better to get rid of a guy a year too soon than a year too late. Well, they make me an offer I can refuse. I go to San Diego. The second year there, we end up in the World Series, and two of those 3 years, 83 and 85, the Dodgers lose in the playoff, and I had never lost an NLCS or NLDS. So when you overthink that, I think that once you're not there at first base and you're not getting 400 bats, and you get 400 bats, 450, you're going to drive in 90-plus runs. And Driesen was a very good ball player. But what happens when that transition comes is now we have the emphasis to have one player like yourself not be in that lineup that made the difference in us going the next 2 years. Right. So
the thing is, I played 10 more years of that. They trade me in 76, I retired in 86. I mean, I was still, playing. And that's what you have to, say, well, if we they make a mistake, and they did. They say that. They say that they make a mistake when they trade me away because they didn't know I was so, you know, like it, and, you know, and
well, you were a grinder. You were a grinder. You wanted to play every game like I did, right? I mean, that's what you did. You went to spring training. You got ready to play 162 games. Now, you know, you may get hurt somewhere along the line, but you were going to be ready every day, you know.
Yeah, that's what we used to do.
Yeah, and that's what great teams, the composite of, just like Gary was saying, the guys he mentioned for the Reds comprised seven or eight guys that went out every day. And when we talked about our infield and with Jaeger and Smith and Mundy and maybe a guy here or there, we had basically the same guys every day. And maybe that's the difference in generations between that 70s to 90s, what I call kind of a golden era there, you know, late 60s, to a new millennial time of sabermetrics and hybrid players and managing your body, so to speak, right? If I would have said to Lasorda, or you would have said to Sparky, you know, I think I'll sit out a day or two. I got to manage myself better over this 162 game. They would have used explicatives that we couldn't use right now on this podcast. But, you know, again, that period there, people say, well, wouldn't you like to play now with all the money? I said, you know, some things you can control, some things you can't. But to have played in that generation, and of course, I think a lot of people know the story of me being growing up in Tampa, Florida, and being a bat boy for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 56. Mm-hmm. And for about 10 years afterwards, Dad worked for Greyhound, and to be around my idols and to see, you know, young players like yourself and Pete running across Dale Mabry Avenue to that hotel across from Al Lang Field all the time.
We met in 1960. P and myself, we met in Geneva, New York in 1960. That was how long we know each other. And Pete, who got a birthday coming on the 14th. He got his 80 birthday.
You too?
No, Pete.
Yeah, he's much older than you.
Oh, no, but a year or so. But a year, only a year or so, no.
Hey, roll with it. Come on.
You know? No. Everybody say I come up, when I come out of Cuba, I call myself younger because I never said my real age, but I didn't do that. I didn't do that. I said the right one. I don't want to be like somebody else. And when they want to, what they want to collect his pension, I say, I don't know, you 3 years older than that. you say you 45 and now you 43. You cannot.
Yeah, you and Fernando. Yeah, Fernando comes up and says he's 20, right? He was close to Social Security in Mexico than he was to 20.
let me ask each of you, because you've raised the names here, you played under, in the case of the Dodgers and the Reds, two of the great managers in baseball history. Tony, starting with you, a little bit about Sparky Anderson, how he handled the team. He certainly thought the world of you. As I said, he felt you were the heart and soul of that club. What was he like, and what was it like playing for him?
Well, Sparky, he came up in 1970, you know, and I remember a lot of people say when they name him the manager, they say, Sparky who? You know, they didn't know Sparky's name and where he coming from in Cincinnati. But he came down, he took care of everything. He knew the thing we have. We know since 1970, we got a great player. We didn't have Morgan yet. We didn't have Geronimo or Billingham. And so this guy come from Houston after we trade for Tommy Helms and Lee May for that. Mm-hmm. But the Spike, you know, we got a good offense team. We can hit, but we need pitching. And the pitching was a problem. When in 70, we went to the World Series, but when we played the Orioles on the World Series in 1970, pitching, everybody was hurt. We lost Wayne Simpson, a great rookie. We won 15 games, but the All-Star break, and then he hurt himself. And we miss him, and we don't have Gullett yet, and we didn't have those guys yet. But Sparky knew that, and he was building the pitching stuff. And we had guys in the minor league. Don Gullett came up. Grizzly came up. McEnany came up. Eastwood came up. We start getting a better pitching. And then in 72, we trade Lee May and Helms for Morgan, Geronimo, and Billingham. The team was better because we got more speed in the team and better defense at second base with Morgan. And because we had, and then we had the best central, I mean, the middle infield on the lead, the best one. When you have Johnny Bench, Morgan, Concepcion, and Geronimo, that's on the middle, you have to have the best, and that helps us. And then we got the powers on the corners and on the outfield. And the speed was terrific. And Sparky knew the only thing he had to do was get the pitching ready. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. He came out to spin training and say, he had a meeting and say, guys, we got a great team. We got four guys you have to follow. He's talking about Morgan, Bench, Rose, and myself. Don't try to do what those guys do. You just be yourself and follow them, and we play and we go. And because they used to take us to the backfield and spin training, and we had hit and hit and hit, and we must do the hitting, you know, and we go to the to defense too. But you know, we call them out on defense at the middle, and we do in the corner. We peel myself on first base and third. But you know, the offense was there. The pitching came up, and then the big red machine come up because we had a great hitting team since the late 60s. Come get up with a bit better pitching, and then we came out to be the big red machine with everything. We got a great team, and we can play with anybody. And that was Spike was so good. He know what he has to do.
How about with Lasorda, Steve?
Oh gosh, Gary. I mean, you know, we don't have enough times or days to talk about Tommy. You know, we lost him relatively recently, and of course Sparky a couple of years ago. But the two of them, before I talk about Tommy, the two of them were classic competitors. Yeah. You know, and they had a mutual admiration, but they wanted to beat each other. You know, sort of would come into Cincinnati. Every time we came in, starting in 74, we sell out every night. Could be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Could be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the crowd. And then we go to Dodger Stadium, and it'd be sold out. Jonathan Winters and all the celebrities coming out who were Reds fans, you know. And but this typifies a little quick story about Tommy. So he had met Jonathan Winters, knew he was a Reds fan, was going to try to convert him. And Jonathan, you know, had his own mind, so to speak. So Jonathan comes in, Cubhouse, got his Reds jacket on. Lasorda's getting on him. He says, saying hello to each of the guys. You know, he's pretending he's Marty Frickett, and he's killing little kitty cats. And he goes to him, he says, come on into my office. And all of a sudden, Cubhouse guy says, Garv, Tommy wants you to come in. Jonathan's doing a skit. Oh, great. Yeah, but it's only 10 minutes before the game. No, come on in quick. You'll be okay. I go in there, and it's jammed, and he's got this skit where he's the aging relief pitcher in the seventh inning, and he comes in with bases loaded, and he's doing all this stuff, and we're dying laughing, and all of a sudden, he this guy comes in, he says, hey, Wendell Stan's out there. They already played the national anthem, and he's wondering, where the blank are you guys? So the cleats are clattering. We're grabbing gloves. We're going outside. We've been mesmerized by this big Reds fan taking our mind off the game. We get out there, run on the field, and Harry says, Garv, where you guys been? I said, Jonathan Winters was doing this skit. He says, why didn't you tell us? He said, I could have come up with some excuse, you know, to delay this or something. A pipe would have broke. But things like that happened all the time with Reds and Dodgers in Cincinnati. But, you know, Tommy, he, you know, kind of a fourth string pitcher in high school out of this Pennsylvania town from an immigrant family. And somehow, some way he comes up with a curveball and he gets signed by a bird dog scout from the Dodgers. And he works his way through the minors, has a great career, ends up, you know, what, he was 0-4. You know, he, his classic line was, if it wasn't for him, Koufax never would have made it. Because at that time, I think if it was $2,000 or $5,000 bonus, you had to stay up with the major league team for 2 years. And they signed Koufax, and the guy they sent down was Lasorda. And and then they traded him. But, you know, Tommy's got 100 of those. You know.
Yeah, yeah, he wants
them. Right? The times with Sinatra, Sinatra promised him if he got the managerial job, he would sing the national anthem on opening day, and that turned out to be 77. And Frank, again, comes through the clubhouse, and they gave him a satin dollar jacket. He's got that Dodger hat jaunty to the side, and they get the cart, and they take him to center field, and we're all there, and Lasorda is beaming, and we're standing on the line, and Frank, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Sinatra, oh, say, can you see? And all of a sudden, it's over. He forgets the middle stanza for the national anthem, and we're all standing there, and it's Lasorda, myself, and Bert Hooten. And I look at Lasorda, and he looks at me, and he's white. And Bert Hooten goes, hey, Lasorda, who in the heck is that guy? He says, Bert, if you don't shut up, you won't be starting till June. And I'm crying.
Oh,
but those things happened all the time, because he was, I called him the P.T. Barnum of baseball. And he says, what do you mean by that? I said, Tommy, nobody is bigger in life than you are. I mean, on and off the field. I mean, your enthusiasm and Dodger Blue and how you, you know, he was one of the first real psychologists, I think, of that I ever knew as a manager. You know, he knew what buttons to push. He knew that Buckner was high strung and he needed to put his arm around him. Valentine, he needed to kick in the behind, and this guy that. He knew that I internalized, and I, you know, when I was in a slump or striking out, you know, I was more, took it out of more myself. So I think one of his great skills, and probably Sparky too, was the ability to manage these men with God-given skills in the one great profession of their lives, and to get them to maximum performance, and then to bring them together as a team and have his teams have longevity and success. And I think Tommy and Sparky were two of the best of them.
Yeah, two of them. I mean, I hear from Tommy Lasorda since I was growing up in Cuba. He was big in Cuba. He went to pitch there. He remember he pitched winter ball for the Armendariz team. And right. Tommy was the, I mean, you only hear about Tommy Lasorda. He speaks Spanish. I mean, he speaks Spanish to me all the time. He learned how to speak Spanish in Cuba.
Yeah, but he couldn't conjugate, right? We're playing the Dominican.
And people know him. And I grew up, when I met him, I think I met the best thing in the world, because I remember listening about him since I was listening to the game on radio in Cuba with my father. Yeah. I mean, that was something, and the people in Cuba loved Tommy Lasorda. They even have a song on his name. They have joke in his name about Tommy Lasorda.
Hey Tony, like was it? He tells a story of this big Cuban power hitter, right?
Yeah,
and you probably know who he is. And this guy hit a home run.
Excuse me, he told me that about 10 times.
Yeah.
Every time I see him, he told me that.
Right.
One.
Same story, right? He's got categories. He's got Cuba. Mm-hmm. But he tells the story of this guy, you know, gets up there and he's flexing his muscles and he may have hit a home run. And he said, this SOB, he's never going to take a cut like that again. And he hits him and the guy comes out sort of, you know, and Tommy says, this guy who's bigger than King Kong comes out and Tommy drops him with a left, knocks him out on the mound. Right. Now I'm quite sure that the guy was probably chasing Tommy with the bat somewhere. Right?
I believe so. Right? Yes.
I mean, but Tommy, that was Tommy. He got us in more fights in Ogden, Utah. I'd never been to fight in my life until I went to Ogden that first year, and he got us in 4 or 5 fights. I mean, what the heck
Tommy,
is this?
Tommy was charity. He was the best. I tell you what, he was the best telling jokes and telling things about it. And I don't want to say lie because I don't want to tell he lies about him, but he put too much on it. I mean, he put it bigger than he was.
That's right.
like with this guy he's talking about.
Oh, well, man, you know, he had Milton Berle and all these guys from the Friars Club in L.A., his friends, and he'd say, I can tell you 10 jokes you've never heard before. Well, he had gone to these guys who have these big Rolodex, you know, who do these Friars Club roasts, and he was right.
I remember the guy's name now, Chiquitín Cabrera.
That's right.
The Cabrera, that was the name. Yeah, he was big. He was a big black guy with a left-hand, I think he was, too. But he used to kill a soldier.
Yeah, that's right.
He used to hit him well.
If we could find a picture of Chiquitín on the ground with a sword standing over him, yeah, I'd pay a lot of money for that one, wouldn't you? Yeah.
He said he got it. He hit him with a laugh, I think.
That's
crazy.
That's
funny, boy.
Guys, I told you we'd go through this, and you have. I mean, unbelievable. We've already taken your time here. Unbelievable stories. Yeah. I want to ask each of you just one final question to close us out here. Just overall, the memory that you have, not necessarily of a particular incident, but of the time, the team, the people you played with, what comes to mind if you're asked to describe, Tony, I'll start with you, your days with the Big Red Machine. What do you think of?
Well, I think, you know, coming to the ballpark, you know, I feel, you know, look around me, look around and see what the guys I play with. I believe we can, and I ask myself, we cannot lose a game. I don't think we can beat anybody. That's what I think, because I can, in my mind, I can to win a ball game and, you know, and I know the team we have and that's what I think. I come out and do my job, and I'm trying to help the pitching. That's what I was trying to do, and it's what I remember. And we know we got to play like you're talking about the Dodgers and Cincinnati. We knew we had to beat the Dodgers. We want to win, and they know they had to beat us when they want to win. And that's what the rivalry was, but that's the thing I must remember. The guys on my team and the guys, how they play and how they do everything to win a ball game. We wasn't perfect. What we're trying to do, most perfect when we play the game.
Steve?
And I think the sign of a great franchise is its ability, and it starts really in the minor league system in the draft, is to really understand talent, understand the needs of your organization, and then to systematically put together the pieces that, and of course, we're talking about basically, we start before free agency and options, but both organizations put together this group, I would say, of probably 25, 30, 35 players over a 10, 12 year period that were brought together, and they were nurturers, and they were taught great teachers in the organization. And then they were managed by Hall of Fame managers. And they went out with a controlled aggressiveness every night. And they wanted to be perfect. And in the quest for perfection comes excellence. And 8 of the 10 years that the Dodgers and the Reds in this great rivalry played each other, one of those teams went to the World Series. So those two teams typified what professional baseball at the major league ultimate level can be when it's done the right way. And Tony, we haven't mentioned one thing. All those years, we never had a fight. Maybe once in a while, there was a little yelling. If Lasorda yelled at Sparky and back and forth, it was a little tongue in cheek. We had this mutual respect for the way the game was played. They played it. We played it. Respect for each other. Win or lose. That was always that, you know, a tip of the cap and we'll get you tomorrow, or you'll get us the next day.
That's right.
But it is a period that if you take those two teams and you do a book on it, it could be about excellence and about the soul of what the game should be.
Our great thanks to Tony and Steve. Tremendous insights on two really great baseball teams and two of the leaders of those ball clubs. We thank them for joining us. And a word from our sponsor, betonline.ag. Head to the website, betonline.ag, or use your mobile service device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. And that's going to conclude another chapter of These Sports Rivals presented by BetOnline. You can find the show at Believe.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the show. To learn more about this episode and others, please log on to thesportsrivals.com. You can join our conversation with questions and suggestions for future shows. Also, follow us on Instagram at thesportsrivals, Twitter at rivals_podcast, and Facebook by searching for The Sports Rivals Podcast. Thank you for joining us, everybody. And as was made clear by our guests Tony Perez and Steve Garvey, remember, it is the rivalries that make the games.